You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, July 13th. Eek! 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Gower Lunch District of New York City. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is Friday the 13th. As such, I am hiding out in a sub-basement somewhere, afraid of going outside, getting hit by a black cat that falls from a ladder, and having someone make me lose the lottery. I don't know. I'm not here. But does that mean that you're not going to get new content? No, of course not. I always think of you. I always think of you before I think of me. In fact, I think of you, and then I think of everyone around you. Then I think of Matt. Then I think of me. No, cancel that. I think of you. I think of everyone around you. I think of my family. Then I think of Matt. Then I think of me. So today I have for you three interviews. Yes, three. You're going to have a great weekend. First up, Guy Lawson. You know him as the Rolling Stone reporter. He came on this show in the past to discuss the story of the stoners who made the biggest deal of armaments to the U.S. government in its history. He has written a book called Octopus, Sam Israel, The Secret Market and Wall Street's Wildest Con. It's an amazing book. You're going to enjoy this interview. He's a friend of mine. We were very lucky to have him come on the day of the release of the book. And of course, then to screw him over, I played it on Friday. Also on the program, EJ Graff, writer from the Prospect magazine. I caught up with her at Netroots Nation last month. And finally, when I was at Netroots Nation, I agreed to sit down with a Tea Party YouTube person. And name is Susie Sampson. I know some of you are going to be a little bit annoyed with me that I didn't really hammer the Tea Party as much as I should have, but I was interested to see what would happen when I spoke to her. And, well, we recorded it. So we're going to play it for you. So enjoy today's program. Guy Lawson, EJ Graff, Susie Sampson. And we will see you on Monday once again. Enjoy today's show. We are back on the Majority Report. I am Sam Cedar on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to this program a writer for Rolling Stone and author now of two books. His latest is Octopus, Sam Israel, The Secret Market, and Wall Street's Wildest Con. My friend, Guy Lawson. Hello, Guy.
Hey, Sam.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm very well, and I'm delighted that today is publication day of Octopus. And
that's right.
This is my second interview. I did one on CBS, and I came straight from broadcast television to the telephone line of the Sam Cedar Report.
Well, it's actually the Majority Report, and I'm not offended that you went to CBS first. I understand that. It is, and of course, it is. We're recording this on Tuesday. The book is finally released. Now, I have to say, now I had heard this story from you a while back. I mean, you've been working on this book for a couple of years now, and when I read the book, I have to say, there was a moment when I was reading this in the middle of the book that I turned. I was reading it in bed, and I turned to my wife Nikki and I said, "This is just. I cannot believe this." and so I first of all, I want to thank you because I rarely read a nonfiction book that is so just blatantly enjoyable. But and let's talk about the really sort of the fun parts of this. And then, you know, it really ties into a lot of the themes that are going on in society. Tell us the story of Sam Israel.
Sam, you're breaking up on me. I don't know what's happening.
Oh, well, I can hear you. So
okay, sorry. I don't want to break that. I'm losing you a little bit on the voice there. But let's continue, obviously.
Okay,
Do you edit our stuff?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. So I can pick up. Do you want me to start up?
Yeah, so just tell us the story of Sam Israel.
Well, the thing, you know, Sam, you know, we see each other and we're buddies, and I was telling you the story. The thing about this story is you kind of need a book to tell it. It's not something, you can't really get this story over a barbecue or, you know, in an interview, but hopefully I can give your folks a good sense of it. Sam Israel was born into one of the most successful and prominent commodity trading families in the history of the United States. The Israels and the Aarons were and are very powerful and successful traders of things like soy and cocoa, you know, all the sort of stuff of modern life, coffee. Sam's great-grandfather started out with $10,000 in 1895, and by 1910 he had $25 million, which is the equivalent of $500 million today. So Sam was born into this sort of legendary family, and in New Orleans was the family's base. And then they moved to New York, and his family, he grew up at the Century Country Club, which is the most exclusive country club in the country. His family, his father played golf with, you know, Alan Greenspan and Sandy Weill and Larry Tisch, and he chased around with their children and dated their daughters. And, you know, he was born into kind of royalty, American royalty. And so by the time he was, you know, and he knew from an early age, he had a difficult relationship with his father, and he knew that he did not want to become like the other Israels. He didn't want to become another person who moved into the family business and had all that kind of, you know, like the kind of the entitlement, of inherited entitlement. He wanted to go out and make himself his own man, and that was a huge motivating factor for him, this idea that he could go out and do it on his own, that he didn't need family connections, he didn't need, you know, the job being handed to him. So when he was 18, he started out on Wall Street, and he fell in with this guy named Freddie Graber. And Freddie Graber ran something called a hedge fund. And in the early 1980s, nobody knew what a hedge fund was.
Right.
There was no hedge fund industry. This was for, you know, wealthy people. This is how wealthy people secretly invested their money. It was like a secret. And so Sam went to apprentice to this Freddie Graber guy who happened to be, you know, maybe the greatest cheater of his generation. You know, Freddie knew how to work every angle. He knew how to front run the market, which means to trade ahead of, you know, the big players like the pension funds and insurance companies. He knew how to work soft dollar scams, but most of all, what he knew is how to acquire and use inside information. So Sam, you know, if people are interested in sort of the inside reality of how trading really works and how information is really passed around. Octopus, I think, the first sort of quarter of Octopus really takes you inside that world. So Sam was apprenticed into this world. And
tell me this. What is the difference? Because Sam really trained to be a trader as opposed to, I guess, an analyst or a broker in general.
Or an investor.
You know, or an investor. What does it mean to be a trader?
Well, this is what's really interesting. It's changed, and the reason it changed is computer technology. In the 70s, you know, a trader was somebody who would pick a stock and invest in it, something like what George Soros does or a guy named Leon Cooperman, but what you sort of imagine in a conventional investment bank advising people to do, pick stocks. There was this form of trading, which is high velocity, which is, you know, based on trying to take advantage of immediate movements in the market, ticks up and down, that really doesn't matter what the company you're trading is. It matters only what if it's going up or down, what's going to happen in the next minute or day or perhaps week. But the theory really was that you'd start out the day in cash, you trade all day, and then you end the day in cash. And so you never own a stock. You don't care about that stock. All you're doing is trying to play the moment. And what happened in the 80s was computers came along, and computers made this kind of trading possible on a much, much, much larger scale and much quicker. So really, in the last 20 years, the money that that Wall Street makes is still, to some extent, based on positions and investing in companies, and IBM's got a new computer, or Apple's, got the iPad. But a massive amount of what they make is just this velocity trading, trading like a nanosecond ahead of the market. So Goldman Sachs, will know that there's a big velocity of shares being traded in Procter & Gamble, and they'll go in and they'll make a tenth of a cent, but they'll do it a billion times. And so Sam wanted to be that kind of trader. That kind of trader is, it's sort of like, you're like the tough, hard-assed. I mean, I'm trying to think of an analogy. It's sort of like being like a, like if they had a reality show, it'd be like ice truckers or whatever, those shows.
Yeah.
Like the extreme version. It's like you're the toughest badass on Wall Street. If you're that kind of trader, you're the guy who'll put all his money, you say you got $1 million, he'll put $1 million for 10 minutes.
All of the training essentially and the apprenticing that Sam Israel did sort of gave him this sense that everything that was taking place on Wall Street was a function of somebody had an angle in some way or another. I mean, it wasn't like
every dollar on Wall Street is diced down to the penny.
But I mean, it seems to me that Sam Israel came through this experience. And again, we're only talking about the first quarter of the book here, which is really sort of stunning. But he comes out of this experience, it seems to me, viewing Wall Street, not that you don't have to work hard. The guy was constantly working, it seems to me.
Yeah.
That to really make it in Wall Street, and that anybody who had made it in Wall Street in some fashion or another had figured out an angle in which they were ahead of... There were almost like two classes of people: those who knew what was going on and those who didn't.
Yeah, those who are eating caviar by the spoonful, and everyone else is a chump. It really has a great resemblance to organized crime. If you're a wise guy, you don't have to have a job. I mean, that's not to say that Sam wasn't a worker, but if you're a wise guy, the Wall Street guys were smart guys. They weren't wise guys. They were ahead of the rest of the world is kind of a ship of fools.
And
of course they know 2 days ahead in advance what's going to happen with, the Exxon takeover. Like Facebook, the IPO.
Right.
Are you kidding me? That is institutionalized fraud. The only reason why people were shocked was because it was such a public company. That happens. That's what happens all day, every day on Wall Street. All day, every day.
And we're talking about this now at a time as the LIBOR scandal is just growing and growing. I mean, they're talking about this has been manipulated for years. It seems that everybody knew that this was being gamed.
Of course,
regulators and the bankers. I think we're for whatever reason, it's starting to fall apart at the seams. And LIBOR.
Well, you remember, I started talking to Sam in the September of 2008. I sit down, we'll come forward to the,
September 2008. Now, so this is right before everything falls apart in terms of.
I sit down with Sam and he says, Wall Street's got these so many scams, you can't believe it. And then he says, the Federal Reserve is a Ponzi scheme. The whole thing is bullshit. Excuse me. You, can we do that on your show, Sam?
Yeah, we'll cut it out if we have to.
Oh, really? Okay. But he says, I sit down with him, and he says that the Federal Reserve is a Ponzi scheme. The whole of Wall Street, the whole construct is basically, a fantasy. And 3 weeks later, and I'm sitting there listening to him, and I'm going, And I think that I'm working on a project about a hedge fund fraudster. And he keeps insisting on all these secrets and secret bonds and secret markets. And I'm sort of listening to him thinking, well, I don't know about this. 3 weeks later, the global financial crisis hits, And, you know, I'm watching it, and I realize that Sam actually knows some stuff that's pretty powerful and pretty important and potent, and that I better listen more carefully. And so that really was when I knew I had a book, and that's when I really turned my attention to trying to understand what exactly it was that he was saying.
Now, we should say at this point, the reason why you went to interview this guy, and so let's go. Let's jump to essentially close to the end of the book, because we're not. I mean, this is the at least, you know, most of the broad strokes are known publicly.
Yeah.
How we get from essentially where we've taken Sam Israel, where he was trained on Wall Street, he saw that there was like an edge to be had, and that's the way you end up, that the rest of the world is a sort of a ship of fools, and these guys are the smartest guys in the room. How he ends up to what the public is aware is really, I mean, we could touch on it, but it really is just so wonderful in so many different ways and horrible in so many different ways. But so talk about the part that many people will know about Sam Israel, about the Bayou hedge fund.
Yeah, well, the Bayou became Bayou. So Sam started his hedge fund, called it Bayou because of his Louisiana roots. And, you know, he had this idea that he was going to run this really dazzling, great, honest, no more of this Wall Street fraud hedge fund. You know, he was going to cut out all the nonsense. He was going to really, you know, he'd worked on a computer program he called Forward Propagation. He believed that he, you know, if he could just get this right, he'd be able to really, you know, slay the market. So, but the thing is, you know, he was partnered with a guy who was an egomaniac, there's really no other way to put it, and had made some terrible decisions about which companies to invest in and what industries early on. And so they fell behind. So I don't know how quickly you want me to go through it, but in essence, Sam, they fudged the numbers the first year, but they came up with an accounting trick. And if any of you listeners are investors, you know, Octopus is kind of like a reverse investor's guide. You know, all these books tell you how to invest. This book tells you how not to invest, you know, because you can see how, you know, you get to see how they manipulate the financial statements. They, you know, what to look for in fraud with your investment managers. But, you know, then they just made up an auditing firm, and then they just basically invented the returns. So within 2 years, this hedge fund was, you know, a complete fraud.
He's trying desperately. Now, this is the sort of there's so many aspects of this that I love, because Sam Israel in himself is sort of this incredibly tragic figure who, like you've outlined, and I get the sense that, you know, so much of this had to do with him trying to prove himself to his family in many respects.
Yeah, and he's like this likable, boyish Wall Street guy who doesn't have a mean bone in his body, who's sort of a prankster. You know, he's got this alter ego he calls Captain Proton, that when he goes on a Coke bender, he puts, you know, a cape on. He's the kind of guy who leaps out of a cab at midnight and starts directing traffic at the corner of 42nd and Broadway, you know, just for a laugh. He's this sort of, you know, cut up. But at the same time, because with these hedge fund guys, the more eccentric you are, the more people believe that you're a genius. The more unusual you are, the more attractive you are. And I should add here, you know, that Sam was down the road, as the pressures grew, he was diagnosed as being bipolar. And this is not an uncommon phenomenon on Wall Street. For people that take these high-risk lifestyles, up, down, you know, euphoria and depression, this is like this is the cycle of bipolarity. But, yeah, just give me a minute, okay?
Sure.
Because I think that I have an email from Sam.
Oh, you're kidding.
And this could be a world exclusive for the Majority Report. Let's see. Indeed, I do.
Yes, read it.
All right, you recording?
Yes.
All right, well, so I went on CBS News, Network News this morning, and as I said, this is my second interview. And your readers may not know this, but the federal prison system now has email access for prisoners. And here, world exclusive, subject matter from Sam, I read to you his email to me this morning. Gee, outrageous, dude. That was fantastic. Great segment. I hope I can do as well. You could have at least said self-defense, bro. I'm reading this with you. They can't ever let anything look good. Kick that Gail King doo-doo in the doo-doo. Oprah's best friend? Ha-ha. The guy was good, though. Seriously, that the guy is Charlie Rose. Seriously, good one. Good one, King.
So this is... Okay, so... This is folks who are listening, we're jumping all over the place, but by the end, this will make sense. So this is from.
We can start over.
No. We're gonna keep this through. This is funny because this is, we haven't even gotten to the completely off. So you've got this guy who is the email sort of tells like this guy's in prison basically for life now. Is that right?
You got 20, 22. Well, you know, the thing that we haven't said. That what most of your listeners would remember him by, and we're like 20 minutes into this, is that Sam faked his own suicide. To fast forward, you know, when Sam's fraud collapsed and he got, you know, and the Bayou imploded, Sam was given 20 years, and you know he considered that an outrageous sentence. And I have to say, by and large, I concur. It's just white collar crimes were underpunished, now they're overpunished, which is a kind of society wide bipolarity.
Well, anyway, in this instance. This is not the same systemic fraud. I mean, individuals like Sam Israel and Bernie Madoff were sort of the chum for, I think, the public.
They're the fall guys.
Yes. And now the difference between Sam Israel and Bernie Madoff, it seems, and we were just about to talk about this, is that Bernie Madoff went into his endeavor as a scam. Sam Israel went into it and then – halfway through, I guess, managing this fund, realizes like he's losing. So he starts to lie about his returns, constantly convinced that he can make up the difference. If he just, this is where he turns into sort of like basically the gambling addict, right? Who loses and then keeps going back to the table and says, if all I need is just one big, just let it fall on 32 black.
Yeah, it's a difference between a sociopath, which is Madoff, who, you know, his business plan was to get everybody's money as much as he could and just pray he didn't get caught, against Sam, which is a human being, a real person. And I think people will relate to his story and how his motives were shaped through time. You know, beginning as a boy wanting to please his father and outshine his ancestors to a grown man, still in many ways a boy, who's desperately trying to save himself and his fund and his reputation and his... free, you know, maintain his freedom. The stakes keep rising and rising as the vice grip closes in on him. So yeah, he, you know, over time he becomes a guy, and this is like an existential question that I think that Sam poses, which I think is an interesting one, is he's a guy who needs to make $150 million right away, and he's got $150 million to do it with. So what does he do? You know, like you say, he puts it on red 8.
Well, he doesn't exactly put it on red 8. I mean, I think, you know, like my audience right now is just sort of thinking like, how come I sound so sort of, I guess, enamored in it? Because the part of the story that we're leaving out, which is sort of the bulk of the book.
The whole book's about this.
Is that he gets caught up in what is the functional equivalent, and I'm very familiar with this, and I don't know if I've ever even told you the story, of what is like a Nigerian email scam. And gets caught into it in a way.
Only on the scale and the complexity of, you know, of Kafka.
I mean, beyond, look, about 10 years ago, I was going through a period in my life waiting to hear if I was going to be, my sitcom was going to get picked up. And I got into it with a 401, one of these Nigerian email scams. And yeah. I have 200 pages of emails that I sent back and forth with them as different characters. I have phone calls that I got from Nigeria.
That's part of why I love you.
But Sam fell into this world in such a hard and total and complete way, and came so close. Well, I mean, I don't want to give away exactly what happened, but it is stunning. And more than what is stunning of that, I mean, every single, an octopus, tell us where Octopus, the name of the book, comes from.
So Sam is you know, living in a mansion he rents from Donald Trump for $22,000 a month. He's got a fleet of Porsches. He's, you know, divorced. He sort of looks, you know, he's Bruce Wayne, the millionaire playboy.
Except for he's got massive back problems and a monkey on his back.
Massive back problems. He's the pressure, the psychological pressure of living with so many lies, his physical manifestation of it, the spiritual, all of it is just crushing him at the same time as he's, you know, on top of the world. And so he's trying to figure out how to make this money. Like, give me something. Show me somehow to make this money out, you know, so I can change my life around. Forget about Wall Street. Forget about trading anything. And he encounters this guy. And I think this is, Sam, is maybe the moment when, you know, the you set out into the sea of high improbability, you know, the sea of no way, and the ocean of this can't be true. He meets this guy who was the villain in the first Superman movie. The guy, he's a giant. Remember if you remember the guy who played Jaws in the James Bond movies, like 6'9", with a silver. He's that guy. He's not that actual guy, but he's a lookalike. He's the sort of the B-movie version of that guy. And he tells Sam that he knows a CIA guy who operates out of London with access to a secret technology, a computer program that can secretly allow Sam to view the money movement inside the Federal Reserve and inside the leading banks in the world. Sam spends a night going online researching this guy, and his name is Robert Booth Nichols. Robert Booth Nichols is a superstar of the conspiracy world. This guy dealt heroin in Lebanon to support the Falangists in the wars there in the 80s. He was inside Iran-Contra. He was, you know, he's basically, any time the United States has done did something nefarious in the 1970s and 80s, Nichols was there, or at least that's what's alleged. The guy lived completely off the grid, never paid any taxes, never had any income, no Social Security. He really is this mystery man. And Sam reads this book called, it's an unpublished book at the time, called The Last Circle. And it's the story of a journalist named Danny Casolaro, who became famous in the early 1990s because he investigated these conspiracies and was working on a book he was going to call The Octopus. And Casolaro became convinced that there's this extreme right-wing cabal inside the United States intelligence agency organizations that effectively lives above and beyond the law. It murders, this group murders, this group steals drugs. They do anything that they want in order to sort of live out America's foreign policy insanity and essentially rule the world. The thing that happens to Casolaro is that as he closes in on this story and as he encounters Robert Booth Nichols, he gets, quote-unquote, suicided. He winds up dead in a hotel in West Virginia, with his wrist slashed and a dubious kind of suicide note next to him. This was very controversial.
You know, I remember when that happened. I remember reading about that.
Time Magazine, The Man Who Knew Too Much, Vanity Fair, Village Voice, HBO was going to do a series on it. You know, it scared, it terrified people because it seemed like Casolaro had glimpsed some alternate reality and then been murdered for it.
And frankly, you know, even after reading your book, which doesn't directly relate to that, I'm not convinced of the veracity or the lack of veracity of that theory, frankly.
Yeah, exactly. What came? I spent basically a year of my life trying to figure that out, and then I finally twigged that it didn't matter. Like, per se, what matters is that Sam believed it. That Sam moved into this universe, and he went towards this Robert Booth Nichols guy. Anybody else reading that story about Danny Casolaro would run a million miles in the other direction. But this was Sam and his risk-taking. You know, this was Sam rolling the dice. This was Sam saying, you know, I'm going to try anything. You know, like, I have balls of steel. I've got big balls.
And he also had a tremendous amount of desperation.
Yes, and a tremendous amount of money. I mean, I would urge your listeners to write out the number 150 million and look at all those zeros. It's an epic ocean of money. And so Sam travels to London on a pretext to meet with this Nichols guy. And Nichols basically, in a scene that's just straight out of Hollywood, as far as I'm concerned at least, you know, turns Sam away from this computer program and Danny Casolaro and says, look, Sam, there's a secret bond market. There's a Federal Reserve runs a high-yield bond market, and I can get you into it, but you need to have $150 million in cash. And the next day, Sam wires $150 million to London.
All right,
that's when he enters the octopus.
Okay, so and we're barely touching on just how insane it becomes at that point. Okay, now,
yeah.
So all right, I don't want to go into that anymore because I want people have got to read this to believe it. It is so stunning. There's only one other point I want to make about the plot because I want to sort of draw back out here because there's some very relevant themes in this book that really struck me. But the one thing I have to mention, and this is what I kept emailing you about, I kept telling you about, at one point in this story,
I know where I'm going.
At one point in this story, all of a sudden, you know, because like you're just thinking, okay, Sam is living in wherever it is in Connecticut, and Darien or wherever one of those places is. And he's got this tremendous amount of money. He's living in Trump's house, like $22,000 a month. He's running
Literally.
This scheme. He's completely, he seems to me to be completely just sort of like untethered in some respects,
yeah.
but functional enough so that people don't realize it. And then all of a sudden, just one of the buddies that he sort of calls on to help him is John Ellis, the John Ellis who... who is George Bush's cousin who called the election for George Bush in 2000 for Fox News and could be as responsible as anybody for those 8 years of George Bush. And he's one of Sam Israel's buddies who is willing to basically actually approach the White House at different times. Based on this scam, it's so hard to grasp because this is where sort of like, this is, you know, everybody else that you know, that you could possibly be aware of sort of more publicly is part of this scheme, you know, the Danny Casolaro, whatever, all these other figures who are sort of part of this sort of dark, you know, conspiracy world. And then all of a sudden, John Ellis shows up, and
it's even more than that because John Ellis is that journalist who called the election for George Hurst's cousin.
I'll allow you to call him a journalist.
Yeah, well, there you go, and a pundit, whatever you want to call him, and now he said at that time 2003-04 he'd set himself up as a venture capitalist, so he was promoting various companies and working with a fund. And so he and Sam knew each other from their sons being together at this elite private school in Westchester. And so Sam said to him, you know, looking again to make a lot of money really quickly, you know, if you have any companies, you come across any companies that can go from 20 to 200 million fast, bring them to me. So Ellis starts presenting companies to Sam, and he starts to make money out of Sam. So the relationship isn't just like a straight-up buddy thing. Ellis is really kind of in business with Sam.
Right.
And becoming more and more, I don't know how to put it, but the dependence maybe is too strong a word, but, you know, he's making money out of his interactions with Bayou.
Right. Sam
but
is the
Sam
t-
comes,
Sam is
when
the
Sam
team.
Comes to him, when Sam comes to him one of the most incredible scenes, you know, in recorded human history, not to be hyperbolic, but as he comes to him with this guy, Robert Booth Nichols, this CIA guy. And the CIA guy says to John Ellis, number one, I know where Osama bin Laden is. This is 2004. He says, he's being hidden by the Pakistani army. And I can bribe the Pakistani army to give him up. And that will enable your cousin, George Bush, to win the election because he will have caught Osama bin Laden. Okay? Then Nichols says, I also have access to a secret cache of Federal Reserve bonds hidden in caves in the southern Philippines that the Japanese stole from the Chinese in the Second World War, and I can get my group of former CIA operatives, special forces soldiers to stage an attack on these caves on the island of Mindanao to recover these Federal Reserve bonds. And this is an imperative for national security because this is a Muslim-dominated area, and these bonds could get into the hands of Al-Qaeda. I mean, I don't even know where...
I think we could just literally don't even have to talk any more about it. You got to read the book to find out more.
And then Nichols says to Ellis, and I need a special diplomatic passport. It's called a black passport that is only available to super spies, Jason Bournes, and no one can stop me at any border in the world and ask me any questions because I'm going to be dealing in the most explosive financial instrument ever to be transacted. And I want you, John Ellis, to go to your cousin, President Bush, because only President Bush can do this, and get this diplomatic passport issued.
But the best part about this to me is that John Ellis didn't just nod his head and go, sure, sure, and then sort of like never come back. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, okay,
yeah.
I can see John Ellis will be like, right, definitely. I'm going to do this. Bye, guys. And then you never hear from him again. But he apparently, at the very least, pursued it to some extent.
Yeah, and even better than that, he contacted a guy named Fred Fielding, who was chief counsel.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. He went to the White House about this. It's not like he just said, okay, you're crazy, and leaves the house and says, boy, wow, honey, you wouldn't believe what happened to me today. No, he contacts the White House.
Yeah, and even better than that, Fred Fielding comes back and says, this is, I don't know what this is, but it's probably illegal, and it might involve the CIA, so back off.
Yes.
So even Fred Fielding doesn't say, this is insane.
Right, and no, that's the thing, is that I'm not so sure that, you know, we don't really know where this guy lands. But, all right, so people got to read the book in terms of this plot, because it's just, it really is just so just crazy. Now, let me ask you this. Now I know, and you mentioned this at different...
Are we going to talk?
You mentioned this in the book at different points, that you believe that Sam believes everything he's saying.
Here's the thing. So I sit down with Sam, and he starts telling me this story in prison. And none of this story has ever been reported. Sam's never talked to anyone before. And I'm listening to this, and I'm trying to, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. And I like to think I'm not a fool. And so, you know, I just think this sounds like malarkey. So Sam says, you know what? I'm going to get my lawyers to give you all of my documents. And I don't mean Sam's going to go through them and pick them out. I mean all. So I go and spend $500, $1,000 on photocopying in Midtown Manhattan, and I get like 10 boxes of every travel record he's got, every bank statement, all the wires, all the depositions. And you know, and let me just say this here too, that the public record of this case, as it was reported in the press, was that Sam was a Bayou, the Bayou was a fraud, Sam was a scammer, he got 20 years, end of story. There were other legal proceedings taken against Robert Booth Nichols and other people involved, including John Ellis having to testify. All of it was placed under seal. It was never supposed to be released. But, you know, I got lucky and I was industrious and someone leaked it to me. So really, the essence of this story would have just been Sam talking, you know, in prison and sounding like a crazy person. But there was so much evidence to corroborate what he said, to underscore what happened with Ellis, what happened with Nichols, what happened with Fred Fielding, you know, what happened with a special forces soldier, and you know, so I'll just give you an example: the secret bonds hidden in the caves of southern Philippines that were stolen from the government of Chiang Kai-shek during the Second World War by the Japanese as sort of plundering loot in the Rape of Nanking. Okay? Sounds like nonsense to me, right? I spend a bunch of time researching that. I talk to the leading historians of the Federal Reserve and the leading historians of economic diplomacy during the Roosevelt administration, and here's what they say. It's likely that the Federal Reserve did issue secret bonds. I don't even know, you know, I mean, it seems to me, you know, Tom Wolfe called it the deep weirdness of modern America. It is deeply weird. This stuff is just like, you know, what waters do these people move through, you know?
It's well, now let's talk about those waters a little bit, because as I'm in the middle of reading your book, I go and see Chris Hayes speak on his book, Twilight of the Elites,
right,
and America After Meritocracy. And he talks about the about all the ways that our elites are failing and have failed, particularly in what he called the failed decade, the past 10 years.
Yeah.
And he talks about this sort of like cult of smartness, that smartness somehow, if you're smart, there's this sort of like you have this sort of license to be able to do anything, supposedly. And
right,
that it gives you a ticket into everything, and how our system, our meritocratic system is such that it is now sort of eating itself, and it is causing a diminishment of our elites. And your book, I mean, just everything from sort of like Sam's sense of what the elites are to John Ellis, who I think, you know, you could safely call an elite. I mean, the guy's the cousin of the sitting president. He has the ability to call the White House and get an answer.
Sam was invited to the inauguration, the second inauguration. Come to the ball. I have the Christmas card from the Bushes.
So, I mean, this all just speaks of a sort of a larger societal problem. I mean, the reason why he got sucked in, it seems to me, into this big con is because it seemed so believable to him, because everything he saw on Wall Street suggested that that's the way the world worked.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is when you enter into a kind of a scenario where, you know, a lot of things become kind of almost religious icons. You know, the Federal Reserve, for an example, you know, it has a lot of the qualities of a church. And, you know, and a modern one, a Mormon-like one. You know, it was founded in 1919 or 1917. It's, you know, they may as well say the Second Coming's in where is it again, Missouri?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, it's you know, there are elements to the way society is constructed that are fiction-like. So that when you are Sam Israel, when you are calling into question everything, well, then everything starts to look questionable. You know, if you scratch at John Ellis, you know, you find underneath a guy who is probably desperate to keep on Sam's good side, you know, and afraid of upsetting his cousin or doing something to make himself look, you know, gullible. But at the same time, you know, John Ellis, who called the 2000 election, as you say, he disagrees with that, but you know, he can contemplate the possibility. You know, that these things are possible, that Robert Booth Nichols really is, you know, a Jason Bourne. That,
yes.
That the world really is a Hollywood thriller.
Yes. I mean, these people who are at the sort of the at the very least in the court of the elite. For them,
yeah,
these notions, which we would hear and say, this is ridiculous, they had a ring of truth to them. And it makes you a little bit nervous as to what's really going on up there.
Well, this is that's the fall of 2008 and the global financial crisis. You know, to me, in a nutshell, it's like, you know, okay, you know, Sam was like the kid shouting out the emperor's wearing no clothes. You know, the kid happened to be naked as well. But, you know, so what happens really is that Sam steps into a universe in which he, the con man, is being conned. It becomes evident over time that Robert Booth Nichols is running a confidence game on him. And this confidence game is bewildering in its complexity and also incredibly intense in its physical and emotional, the pull of it, you know, how Nichols draws him in, controls his mind, his thoughts, his fears, and essentially turns Sam into a character in a Jason Bourne movie. And you know, I don't want to spoil the book for people, but essentially it all is driving towards what happens to the $150 million. Will Sam keep it in play, or will he take it back to New York? And there's a murder scenario in the book that you know, it's hard to find stories that do something that has never been done before, but I think, you know, this murder scene, I've never seen anything like it, not to boast of my book. I just mean the story inside it.
It really is just a stunning story, and it's so. I mean, this is the part. I mean, aside from this is the part that's sort of scary. The John Ellis part. I mean, I know, like, I'm fixated on that. You know, I'm fixated on it, and it's not just because it's just like this is where this sort of completely strange, sort of what feels like insular world that's running sort of parallel to the real world intersects with the real world in such a huge way that it really starts to make you question the underpinnings of a lot of stuff that we take for granted.
It's sort of Broadway Danny Rose meets the Matrix.
It's completely off the hook, and it's just I don't even know. It's just an amazing story, and you tell it very well. And I know the tremendous amount of work that went into it. I know how many people you spoke to, and the story is.
It's kind of like you know, setting out to report Harry Potter.
Yeah.
But the thing about it is that there really is a Hogsworth. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, there really is, like, this thing really did happen. I have these documents. I have the courtroom testimony. I have the wire statements. I have the travel records. I have all this stuff. Every time Sam would tell me something, I go, oh, come on, man. And I'd go and look it up, and I'd see the document. You know, Sam became something called the quote-unquote benefactor in this high-yield market. Sam was going to cure AIDS.
Oh, well, that was the other part of this whole thing, is that Sam was very proud about it because he understood this whole thing to work. Without getting into it too much, Sam understood that almost all major sort of like societal and charitable sort of foundations and organizations were actually tied into this secret market, and he was going to be a big philanthropist. I mean, let me ask you this before, because we just got a couple minutes here. Have you, like, has anybody ever come to you and say, like aside from this story, or maybe this is a question I got to ask you in 6 months, but have people approach you and say, hey, look, I know you've dug into this. Here's another big piece of maybe not Sam's story, but this other story that.
Yeah, I suspect that's coming.
I mean. Right, you're going to be the guy, right? You're going to be sort of somehow woven into this lore.
Well, you know, there's a woman out in California named Sherry Seymour who wrote a book called The Last Circle, which was published last year, and it's sort of, you know, it was what inspired Sam to go into the octopus, so to speak. And this author tried to live through what Danny Casolaro had gone through, and you know, I'm now in her book. There's a way in which, you know. I'm sort of entering into this universe, but I have young children. I have a responsibility. I have a wife. You know, I'm just not inclined to be the guy that goes off into La La Land. But I'm sorely tempted, I have to say, to go to the Philippines and hunt for these bonds.
Well, if you actually are planning to do so, let's talk about that off air, because I may be able to take a week or two. And certainly, I think my audience would appreciate my figuring out some way of funding this program.
Well, you know, it's $1 trillion worth of bonds.
Well, look, all I need is just one box full.
Yeah.
I don't even need the full trillion.
But watch out. It's booby-trapped with chemical weapons and explosives. So if you don't open it at a 45-degree angle... It's wiped out.
I got a whole plan for that. We bring a portable tub. But let's talk more about that when we get off air.
Let me leave one last thought. I don't know if we're ending now, but this story, when Sam began to tell it to the FBI, they wound up. Sam told them that he had a box of these bonds in a vault in London. They had to shut down. Like 6 square blocks of central London and send in the London bomb squad to get these bonds out of this vault in London. That's how much the FBI believed it's possible that Sam really had entered into a parallel universe.
And it's still unclear as to whether or not he hadn't.
That's it. You're exactly right.
Guy Lawson, the book is Octopus. You can we'll have a link at majority.fm to pick up the book, but of course you can go to guylawson.com to buy it on Amazon as a Kindle, Barnes & Noble, Nook, IndieBound, iBookstore, Random House, however you want to buy it.
Please support your local bookstores.
Yes, and Guy says support your local bookstores. So it's a great book, folks. I cannot recommend it enough. I still I'm going back for a second read. It's just so
I'll
crazy.
Come on again. Well, you know, I'll come on again if your listeners ever want to have that happen. I'd be delighted to come on. I'll answer questions. I'll do whatever you like, man.
Oh, that'd be great.
You know.
All right. Well, I appreciate it, Guy Lawson, folks. Congratulations on the book, Guy.
Thanks, Sam. I love it.
The majority, not the sheeple. We are the majority. We the people. Why do we walk the walk? Why do we talk the talk? Why don't we just stand by?
Continuing our coverage at Netroots Nation, joining me now is E.J. Graff. She is the author of What is Marriage For? The Strange Social History of Our Most Intimate Institution, and a contributing editor at the American Prospect. E.J., welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, all right, you've just had a piece in the Prospect, ostensibly reviewing Linda Hirschman's new book, How the Gay Rights Movement Won. In this case, it was Victory, the Triumph of the Gay Revolution, How a Despised Minority Pushed Back, Beat Death, Found Love, Changed America for Everyone. I want to use this as a jumping off point about how the gay rights movement won. How did the gay rights movement win? Has it won yet?
I'll take the latter question first because it's a little bit easier. We've won. We're going to win. Let's put it that way. We're going to win 5-10 years at the outside. We're going to have marriage nationwide. And I don't know if your listeners can see me doing my little we won dance, but
they can't. It's audio.
It just makes me giddy, because I did come up when, you know, you could have kids on the street yelling really quite horrible things at you if I came up when it was bad, let's put it that way, back in the Pleistocene era. And the fact that I'm married now and that I have total confidence that my marriage is going to be recognized by the federal government within 5 years and nationwide in 10 is just astounding to me.
When did you have a sense of, when did we reach that point? I mean, was it really marked by President Obama's, or was this something that you felt confident about a year ago, 2 years ago?
I've been writing that for about 7 years, would say, that we were winning and we are going to win. I mean, look at the numbers. The numbers move steadily upward. There's no turning back. There's more approval for same-sex marriage every year. When we won was when, the mark where I thought you could really say that we won would be, you know what, I'm going to answer a different question myself. The turning point came 92-93 when Bill Clinton started talking about us as an honorable minority that could be included in the sort of progressive or democratic, really, vision of the country. That was the first time that had happened. I was really stunned at that 2 year period where heterosexual people were discussing our issues as civil rights issues. And once that happened, there was a lot to do. There was still a lot to do for a long time, and I couldn't say then that we had won, but we had. That was when it happened. And in 93, there was a massive march on Washington. There had been several before, maybe not several, two. There had been two before, but the mainstream media had not covered it at all. And that was the point where they started covering us as ordinary human beings, not just as drag queens and dykes on bikes. We love the drag queens and dykes on bikes, but to show us in the full panoply of ordinary to outrageous was extremely important turning point. Of course, that came after AIDS, right? I mean, men had been dying for, at that point, a decade, a little more than a decade. And the thing Linda Hirschman gets right in her book is that it was a really desperate thing for some really powerful white men. They were going to die. It didn't matter how much power they had. It didn't matter how much access they had. They were still going to die. And people did not care. And what have you got to lose at that point? They lay their bodies down in the street, you know, in front of Wall Street. If you're going to die, you're willing to use everything to win. So a lot of people started coming out partly because of that. Partly because our organization started winning very small victories. You know, you can inherit an apartment. You can keep your job in New York State if you're gay. You'd be able to have custody of your child if you come out. All those little things made it possible for more and more people to come out. And this is a Barney Frank line that I'm not going to get exactly right. But once people realized they already knew us, we weren't so shocking.
Right.
And this is where there's not a lesson for other movements. Because unlike just about any other movement, we're already right there in your families and your workplaces. The thing that had to change was that we were willing to stand up and say, I'm fine, I'm here. And when you say those things, you're talking about your sister, right?
Right.
You're talking about your cousin who you love. And that was easier, of course, when we started, you know, that.
What initiated that moment was a sort of personal journey of that literally, I mean, this is one of those cases where this revolution, to the extent that there was a revolution, or at least this emancipation struggle, started with the individual who's willing to identify
Absolutely.
Themselves that way to even their family.
First to themselves, right?
Right.
First to themselves, then to a circle of friends who are not necessarily gay, then to the family. And Linda Hirschman's book does mark the major moments where some of those changes happened, right? There were incredibly brave people in the 50s who were willing to be out when destroyed your life.
Right.
Those are really brave people. Then there comes Stonewall, which, you know, we all know from the balloons, but really was a dramatic moment.
And from the balloons?
You know, the parades, the floats, you know, the Mardi Gras beads, the frivolity. But it really was a dramatic moment where it changed from a very very cautious movement to a 1960s sort of movement that built on the tactics of the women's movement and the Black Civil Rights Movement. She gets a number of the high points and how it moves forward. And I would say that the after 90, so that's 1969. Mm-hmm. Then comes AIDS, which brings the men and the women together, because we really were separate movements until AIDS. For a variety of reasons, it brought us together. Then comes 92, 93, where all of a sudden, after a decade of watching us die, or watching the men die and help each other through that, a lot of places, and I mean specifically news media places like the New York Times, started realizing that they respected those, their colleagues, their friends.
Right.
And so they started covering things in a way that did not despise us.
So
This is obviously a very big picture view. I mean,
of course.
Heroic things after that,
of
and
course.
Are still doing heroic things.
But let's look at the. I want to sort of drill this conversation down a little bit, because to and at the same time broaden it out.
Yes.
If this makes any sense. The activism by the LGBT community over the past 3 years.
3 years, okay.
Has been cited as evidence and as sort of a as a model for progressives who are looking to affect greater change with the Obama administration, with our, you know, on issues of economic justice, right, primarily. And give me your sense of how applicable what the gay movement has done.
Here's the thing to remember, I think, is that there is no economic cost. There is no power cost to recognizing LGBT issues. Right? Nobody loses anything. Somebody gains. It's purely a good feeling movement. And I mean, the only people who lose are, it's an ideological loss, right? The people who really think that we're going to hell and that we're polluting the country, they have a loss, but they don't have any loss in their families. Whereas feminism, if women win, the balance of power changes both at work and at home for men.
Right.
Right. Economic justice, the balance of power changes for the people who have the most power in the world. Whereas LGBT people are distributed into every zip code, into every class, into every family, into every workplace. We're already there, and allowing us to love the people that we love has no cost whatsoever.
Right. And so it's not the same type of battle. And I mean, specifically because of that. I mean, I think that's my sense as well, is that the economic playing field is a fundamentally different playing field.
Almost every other playing field is. I mean, immigrant rights. There's redistribution of power and opportunity and almost everywhere. And I don't want to be completely sour, but I do think that's why on this issue we're such winners, and pretty much everything else progressives feel like jumping off a cliff.
Right. Now, let me also ask you, do you think that there's that there are politicians who have in the past used gay rights, used marriage equality rights as a sort of like a Trump card, or, you know, they've kept it in this ace in the hole.
In which sense?
You know, Cuomo can go and attack unions and cut teachers and whatnot, but I'm gonna show my bona fides to the progressive community by saying, look, I'm for marriage equality.
Yeah, absolutely, of course, of course.
I was trying to make that a more interesting question.
I agree with you. Very incisive point.
But I don't think that's obvious to people.
It's not.
I don't think now. You know,
and in a way, it's not progressive at all. You know, in a way, it's libertarian.
Marriage equality.
Well, not just marriage equality, but all of LGBT rights.
Expand on that. I mean, I know you're saying these things, and they may seem
obvious
sort of
to me.
To you. But
you have to ask a pointed question there. I mean, we.
In what way are they not progressive per se, but rather libertarian?
In the way that I just explained, that there is no economic redistribution,
right,
that there is no shift of power, that people who are powerful remain powerful and people who are powerless remain powerless, it's progressive in the sense that more people have social freedom, and that's something we believe in deeply. And yet, the libertarians come out for us much more quickly than the conservatives, who don't want anything to change, because if you change any little thread in a fabric, you know, the whole garment is going to come apart. Right.
Right.
That kind of, like, conservative of, and we know I'm leaving aside the religious conservatives entirely, because they have their own reasonings for why they're against us. But if you're a libertarian, it's easy to believe in both gun rights and same-sex marriage. You know, a person should have their own should be able to control their own lives?
It's a fascinating question, and frankly, I haven't heard really. I mean, as obvious as it may sound to you, I haven't heard many people who sort of discussed it in that context. But
do you think
from a, you know, and maybe this has already taken place, but with marriage equality, when it ultimately comes, it will, I imagine, even expand the playing field as to who can come out, at least in their own minds.
Of course. And even more than that, it's going to be a profound message to young people, teenagers, preteens. Even the hardest area that the LGBT, I'll say LGB, because T is a whole separate set of issues in that, the hardest area we've got to change is the microculture of the individual family, right? That's an all-powerful world. And you don't, very few people are, like, at five, aware that they're going to be different than their mom and dad, right? Some people are, but for a lot of people, it's like it was for me. And I hate to tell personal stories, but it's true. You get to 15 and you're like, oh, holy shit. I don't want to be like Miss Olson, the gym teacher. Like, no, I don't want that. And then you have to sort of come to terms with it in yourself. If you have an actively hostile family and community, that's obviously much more painful.
Right.
So, but if you can watch Ellen on TV,
right,
and she's talking about being married to her wife,
right,
or if you know, you know, that even if your family says you're going to hell, you can still, if you can last until 16 or 18 and get out, you're going to be able to get married someday. You feel you are still going to be part of the social fabric instead of being cast out into the darkness. That's dramatic.
How do you think it impacts, to the extent that there is a gay culture, how does it impact that? I mean, my sense was that there was a period where, this was just a fairly casual observation. So, this could be completely way off. But I feel that we went through a period, and I don't know when this was, and sometime in the 90s, where there was that, my speculation was that so much of our our society, of our culture, that was about reliving, all of the, bringing back all these TV shows, all this sort of like the replay of like the 70s or the 60s, or was a function of people who really couldn't live their lives as children as who they were. And basically sort of brought that stuff back to sort of reappropriate it in their 20s when they could be who they were and re-experience it. And
okay.
I wonder if, you know, how culture is going to change. And maybe, you know, put that idea aside, that may have no validity. But the idea that you can be yourself at age 12 or 13 or 15 and don't have to sort of unshackle yourself from this sort of armor that you've built to deny yourself from yourself, or you deny who you are from your family or your peers or whatever. All those things, you know, ultimately that will go away for the most part for a lot of people. How will that impact sort of the gay culture in some way? Will it become less of a subculture in some respects? Has that already happened?
It's a great question. And there used to be an internal fight, especially in the 90s, when there was still a huge battle over, was marriage an appropriate pursuit? Like, is this something organizations should be focusing on? And the organizations hated it. They did not want to touch marriage with a 10-foot pole for a lot of reasons, different reasons per organization. And there was essentially a grassroots uprising. People were like, all right, if the task force isn't going to work on marriage, I will. They started new organizations. It's what a lot of people wanted. And I've always felt that the quote-unquote queer culture was for the people who were already, who were either cast out of their households. I mean, I do know a lot of people who were thrown out, literally thrown out of their house at 15 or 16 or in college when they came out. They end up living on the street. You know, there's a huge proportion of homeless teens are gay, right? Something like 40%. And we're only 1.5% of the population. So that's, it's really a tragedy. So those people, they're shoved out of the social world and they have to create a culture for themselves. And there's also the people who didn't really, weren't belongers anyway, right? They were the artists or the crazy lefties or the whatever. Those people, but so those sort of queer culture people, the people who are thrust into it without their consent, who are cast out of the world, thank God they're going to be saved from having to go through that. The people who were going to be outre anyway, they can continue that. But there were always these very ordinary people who just had more hidden lives.
Right.
And they're just going to be more visible. I said at a panel yesterday, sexual orientation is not what makes you queer. So the people who are kind of queer anyway are going to still be kind of queer, but they'll make common cause, at least this is my thought, they'll make common cause with the other alternative culture kind of Southwest, South by Southwest people.
Fair enough. E.J. Graff, author of What is Marriage For? The Strange Social History of Our Most Intimate Institution and a contributing editor, American Prospect. Thanks so much for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, we are live at Netroots Nation. Well, we're live to tape. Netroots Nation 2012. And sitting with me is Susie Sampson of the Tea Party Report. You have a website?
I do. It's a YouTube channel. It's youtube.com/Tea Party Report. Aptly named.
And so tell me about the Tea Party Report.
Basically, I am going out trying to interview with Americans, trying to discover why the liberals are the way they are, and hopefully push the conservative agenda a little bit further, because we all know the media is super left.
Yes. No, super left. And tell me, like, what have you found out about liberals?
I have found that, generally speaking, you're wrong about a lot of things. But I find generally people are kind, and that has been uplifting. There's humanity in everyone.
I will
find the light in your dark heart.
What are we wrong about liberals?
I would venture to guess everything. It's pretty much all topics that we disagree on. But I will say I did come to an epiphany, if you will. On the gay marriage issue, I was talking to some of my fellow conservatives in Orange County, and we have discovered that, or I discovered, that if we just change the name a wee little bit, everyone's happy. So, for instance, I asked them, I said, if we change the name from marriage to mariage, is that all right? And they said yes.
So your proposal is to change the way that people pronounce marriage?
Yes. It is genius.
Is there some type of, I suppose I go to mariage.org or something?
Well,
like
I should start that now, shouldn't I?
So you're saying that if it's just pronounced something different, but
this is not difficult to grasp. Just change the pronunciation. That's all you got to do.
I see. Okay.
Yes.
All right. I mean, that's one way to deal with this. Same rights.
Everything is the same. Like I said, I spoke to some of my fellow conservatives, and I asked them, and they agreed that.
Did you guys like bounce off like a bunch of different things? Like, did you say like you came up with gay mariage?
Mm-hmm.
Did you try something like?
No, it's not gay mariage. It's just mariage for everyone.
Mariage.
Mariage. Mariage for America is actually what I'm terming it.
You're terming it.
I'm terming it, like a term.
I see.
To
okay.
talk about it. I'm from the South, so I apologize.
No. Are you from the South or from California?
No, I'm from the South. I live in Los Angeles. I'm from Southern California, or excuse me, South Carolina. I live in Southern California right now.
I see. Okay. Well, it's confusing. I've lived in multiple places myself. So what else have you found that liberals are so wrong about?
Well, I think, like, take the union issue. That was a big stir. I was talking earlier this afternoon to the president of the Rhode Island Republican Assembly, and he was saying that the union members are confused. And so I'm going to adopt that. They're just confused.
Okay. Confused about what? Anything in particular?
Being part of the union.
They're confused as to the fact that they're part of the union.
Yes. Well, he was saying...
I'm not sure I follow what you're saying.
It's all right. You're a little slower on the uptake this afternoon,
apparently,
I gather.
Yes.
He was saying that union members, they have to spend their little amounts of money to become part of the union, and then they don't have the money left to spend for someone else. So
really? In other words, they pay union dues, and then they don't have that money.
Right. That's what he said.
Right, I see. And this guy from Rhode Island, the state legislator, said...
No, he's not a state legislator. He's just the president of the Rhode Island Republican Assembly.
Oh, I see.
It's just the Republican arm of...
So he's not a legislator. He's just like the... It's just the Republican Party.
Yeah, he's just a man.
I see. Just a man. And, okay, so what other... you've adopted this notion that the union people are confused because they're paying dues.
Right. Well, he said it, and I thought it was sensical.
What did you believe before you found this new sensical thing to believe in?
In fairness, I hadn't given it a ton of thought. I was just listening to what my fellow Tea Partiers were saying. I was just going along with swimming with the salmon, if you will.
Right. What are the other? What is the most important? Why do you consider yourself a Tea Partier?
Well, because it's a historical thing. I'm a patriot. There you have it.
I'm not. You got to be a little more explicit. It's a historical thing, which is
the Tea Party. There was a Tea Party a long time ago,
right?
And so we adopted that name.
Yes.
And we're all patriots.
Okay.
You're not connecting the dots, I see.
No. I mean, I get the fact that there was a Tea Party. You know, the Tea Party was an event. It wasn't a group.
I know, but we've developed into a group. We took a break for like 300 years.
Right.
And we're back.
And you, that's correct. And but are there no, it's just patriots, that's it. Just
yes.
If I say I'm a patriot.
You would be lying.
I would be lying.
Yes.
So you do not believe that I'm a patriot?
No.
Why?
Well, you're part of liberalism.
And my part of liberalism means that you cannot be a patriot.
As it's defined by us Tea Party folk, no.
So just conservatives are patriots?
Generally, yes. I think one or two of you slip in every once in a while.
Slip into patriots?
Patriotism, yes.
Yes. And do you think that all the people who were on that boat in Boston throwing that tea, they were all conservatives?
Obviously.
Really?
Yes. They did a poll back when.
They did a poll?
Yes.
They did a poll of the people who were on the ship in the
yes.
Tea Party.
Yes, they did.
You know, I find that odd and hard to believe because I think that had anybody admitted they had been there, they probably would have gotten in trouble with the British authorities.
Maybe, but I think I read it in my history books.
Which history book is that?
I don't know. It was given to me by one of my conservative fellows.
What were the results of that poll?
Well, the results were everyone was conservative.
100%.
100%.
0% were not conservative.
Correct. That's why 100%
when
I said that
word. What was the question that was asked?
Are you conservative?
Yes or no, and 100% said yes.
Yes.
All right.
100%.
And so what are you doing here, Susie?
I'm trying to better understand the liberal. That's why I moved to Southern California, is I'm trying to better understand the liberal mind, if you will. So
what
I came to Netroots. Los Angeles.
So you moved to Los Angeles to understand from South Carolina.
Yes.
And you came to Netroots to understand the liberal mind. What have you come to understand?
Well, like I said a few moments earlier. You guys are wrong. Right. Yes. Well, oh, you're listening now. I appreciate that.
No, but that's not really understanding. My guess is you thought that before you got here.
Yes, but you guys have not changed my mind.
I see.
Right.
But I thought the idea was to come here to understand liberals.
Understand. See, like I said, you guys, we are human, and I said, like I said, everyone human. Has been really nice. So I have discovered some new things. Mm. Kindness.
So their liberals are now kind but wrong.
Yes.
We're dupes.
Yes. Sure. Dupes or duped?
Okay.
Which one?
You tell me.
I you're think the you're one duped with a D.
I see. And who's you're duping us?
Government.
Government.
President Obama in President particular. Obama.
And I take it you're a Romney supporter.
I mean, absolutely.
Are you not concerned by his sort of straying from what would be considered Tea Party or conservative orthodoxy over the
well,
years?
Well, admittedly, I was not his biggest fan.
Who were you supporting in the...
Originally, I liked Michelle Bachmann.
And after Michelle Bachmann,
once
I think
she,
it's Bachmann.
Well, all right. But once she dropped out, I moved over, and then I was a fan of the Ricks. Either one was better than Mitt Romney at the time.
So you were both a fan of Rick Perry and Rick Santorum, and
yes.
then just Rick Santorum.
And then just Rick Santorum. And you know, and now we're left with Mitt. So just got a glass half full kind of girl.
And we can see your YouTubes on, I'm sorry, what's the...
You can see my videos on YouTube. I don't have YouTubes. I'm just teasing you. You can see my videos on YouTube at youtube.com/teapartyreport.
That's very good. That was a very funny joke that you made.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
Do you have a website too? Or?
No, that is the one. I try to direct all traffic to one location. But I'm on Twitter too. So Susie at Susie Sampson, and then Facebook. You can become my friend, like me, because I'm nice too.
Right. You're very nice. That
Thank
was very
you.
Nice. Thank you for taking the time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Sitting up